Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm William Hague, and last month, for my first ever outing on The Story, I chatted with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Politics has been a very big part of my life. I've even led the Conservative Party. But I love ideas and innovation. I'm fascinated by questions about technology, climate, geopolitics. And so every month I'll be joined by key thinkers and leading figures to talk me through a rapidly changing world. And although I've been thinking about something like artificial intelligence for a few years now, many people have, how much do I really know about it? Every week we are told it will kill our jobs, then that it will save our jobs, that it will bring about a revolution in life-saving health technologies, or that it will ultimately, worst-case scenario, destroy us all. When it comes to artificial intelligence on these sorts of questions, Azeem Azhar is a true global expert. He's founded and invested in over 30 tech companies, including some of the core technology for Amazon's Alexa. His platform Exponential helps people understand AI and its impact on society. His book of the same name explains how technology is leaving us behind and what we can do about it. He's a fellow at Harvard and Oxford universities, helping them design courses on AI. His Contacts book is The World of AI. And recently, he joined us in our London Bridge studio to tell me where it all began.
My dad was working in Zambia for the British government, and we were out there as expats, and my neighbour shows up with this computer. We'd only seen them in TV shows and science fiction shows, or programmes like Star Trek and Space 1999. And when we moved back to the UK, the wonderful British entrepreneur Sir Clive Sinclair was developing his ZX series of computers. And my mum bought us the ZX81, which I still have in my office. And that was really the first time I got hands-on with a computer. And as a little boy, to be able to play with something like that was really remarkable. And I think we were just lucky. It was a lucky moment in time.
We're always told, you know, our cell phone is a million times more powerful than the whole computing power of Apollo 11 when it went to the moon. But if you compare that Sinclair computer to today, just give people some idea of how much we've moved on.
One way to think about this is that a computer is based on chips. Chips have these little things called transistors in them that switch on and off. My ZX81 had a couple of thousand. Your modern 2024 smartphone probably has 10 trillion transistors in it. And that is a measure of how much more processing it can do. So billions of times faster. And that's really a measure of how far we've come.
One of the phrases that really stuck with me from your book is that you said that we're entering an entirely new era of human history, partly because of artificial intelligence. But there'll be many people listening to us who they've heard about artificial intelligence, but they're not sure what it means, what that really covers. It could be the algorithm that is giving you your recommended Spotify tunes, or it could now be a humanoid robot. Give people some definition or some idea of what we're talking about when we say artificial intelligence.
Your question encapsulates the problem with the definition. The phrase AI was dreamed up by scientists in 1956 to come up with a new field of study, a way of researching how we create machines that can behave similarly to humans in the way we express our intelligence. And they chose the phrase artificial intelligence rather than cybernetics because they wanted to exclude a particular professor who they thought might be a bit argumentative. Now, you know, academic arguments are often around very small, trivial matters. And this argument resulted in using the phrase artificial intelligence. So the way I think about AI is AI should really be about functional products that help humans achieve more. That can sit alongside this theoretical field of study and science, which is incredibly valuable. But we should be clear when we're talking today and when people are listening, that a lot of the things that we hear about on the media are the realm of speculative research rather than tangible realities.
Okay, so that's the landscape. And into this, you arrive, Azeem, and your key argument is about the exponential gap. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the technologies are improving exponentially, faster and faster. And the institutions, the rules, the habits, the norms, the government departments that we expect to manage and regulate those technologies, they're static or they're changing linearly at best. And so a gap emerges between the two. And I call that the exponential gap. And unaddressed, it gets wider and wider and wider.
So why are things changing so fast?
First of all, computers continue to get twice as powerful every couple of years or so. Billions of us have them because we all have smartphones. And companies have figured out how to get AI to do useful things. And so that has created an economic incentive to invest more and more and more. Put the three of those things together, it's really powerful rocket fuel, and that's the acceleration.
So now we've got amazing things. You can give a prompt to software and it can come up with a film for you.
Based Not a on, very good film.
But again, that's going to improve a lot, isn't it?
Very quickly.
Or there are new AI tools that can identify cancerous growths from CT scans more effectively than a human can. Are there things, do you think, that AI will never be able to do? Is there anything that is permanently beyond the reach of AI?
That's a philosophical question. It's an important one. It's a very difficult one to address. One side will say that there is some élan vital, there is something special in the way in which biological brains like ours have evolved, the way they interact with each other, that you can't build through engineering. And there'll be others who will say, our intelligence, our awareness, our sense of self obviously arises from a physical substrate, you know, the molecules that make up the cells in our brains and in our bodies. Why should that behavior be tied to the particular type of biology rather than, you know, silicon system? And so in that view, of course, at some point, an AI should be able to do anything that a human can do. And that happens to be the view that I take. Some agree with me, but many people smarter than me take the other view. As to whether that's something that's likely to happen in the next 5 or 10 years rather than much further down the track, I think it will be much further down the track. But very many exceptional computer scientists would say it's going to happen earlier. And the summary of all of that is we don't really know, and there's a wide scientific disagreement about when.
And it will be able, even if it does some things that we can do that it can't do, there will be other things where it can go way beyond what we can do. And that is very exciting, but could be very dangerous. You know, AI is now, they're talking about discovering many types of new materials, dozens more types of materials than have ever been known to science before that we couldn't have worked out ourselves. So this is going to go far beyond human knowledge and cognition, isn't it?
It is, but our tools have always gone beyond our capabilities. That's why we used horses and carts and then cars and power drills and vacuum cleaners. So that there's no difference in a sense. And I'm really excited by some of the possibilities that you have described. You know, we sit on the precipice of this climate crisis where so much of what we need globally is dependent on putting CO2 out into the atmosphere to make the nitrogen fertilizers, to make steel, to make cement and concrete. And we need to find more elegant ways of doing this. I mean, it can't be that cement, which we've used in some form or other for 10,000 years, is the last word in building materials. I mean, there must be a better way. We just don't know how to do it. And what we're starting to see is that AI systems are helping us invent those new molecules and materials, which partly starts to help tackle that, you know, that climate emergency. And so for us to be equipped with superpowers of that type feels like it's a good thing. I mean, it just feels like a good thing.
It might be the way in which we save ourselves. That's it. I don't know if you read the book by James Lovelock, Novocaine, the man who invented the Gaia theory many decades ago, who basically argued in his book when he was 99 years old that it was only by inventing a higher form of intelligence than ourselves that humans would be able to save themselves.
I think that there's a lot in that argument. But just take a look at what's happened with the discovery of particular proteins. So proteins are essential for food, they're essential for pharmaceuticals, and they're also essential for building materials. And DeepMind, which is a company based in London, built a product called AlphaFold. And AlphaFold was an AI system that could discover the structure of proteins. And the average PhD researcher might take a couple of years to uncover the structure of a single protein, which is what you need to know in order to make use of it. AlphaFold essentially found the structures of every protein that is possible, including those that we haven't come across, and it did so in about 18 months. Now, that is manna from heaven. So I'm really optimistic about these tools as tools of scientific inquiry, as tools of productivity, because they make us better.
And this optimism is reassuring, I think, for a lot of people, because last year, thousands of experts, including Elon Musk, wrote a letter to say, wrote a joint statement saying, basically, stop us doing AI. We don't really know how this works. And I looked at that as a former politician, and I thought, well, there's no way anybody's going to stop them. Because, of course, the United States will want better AI than China, and the same the other way around. And also, these are very powerful companies that are pursuing it. So nobody is going to stop it. So we do now have to find the good side of it. We have to engage with it. Just on a, again, on a practical point for somebody listening to us who doesn't know much about AI, how should they actually engage with it?
They can use ChatGPT or one of the other chatbots that's out there. So ChatGPT is this application that you can just type to in ordinary English and it will respond to your questions. And you can talk to it about anything. There are several of them, Gemini from Google, there's one called Claude. And you just need to use them for a few hours before you start to really understand what it can do for you. What do I mean? Well, we've had a lot of rain in the UK over the past few months. My garden was horribly waterlogged. I mean, it was ankle deep. And I had a chat with ChatGPT. I live in North London. I've got clay soil. My garden is this waterlogged in this way. It has these plants. And we had a 3,000 or 4,000 word chat, and it came up with some pretty robust recommendations that helped me avoid having to do really expensive remedial work. I think once you do that, you start to get a sense of what it is to have this power at your fingertips. And so the way I think people get involved is they start to play with it themselves. And I really hope people do.
Why is that better than Googling, what shall I do about my waterlogged garden?
That's an excellent question. When you Google a particular problem that you have, you get a list of web pages. And they might be helpful for that first question you have, but you may have follow-on questions because you didn't understand it the first time, or you've realized something new because you've got the results. So when you're working with one of these chatbots, it's a little bit like talking to perhaps your favorite teacher from school about a subject that you're interested in but don't know a lot about. And once you start to go have that back and forth with the chatbot, you realize that you've got this half intelligence at your hands. Before we met, I told it who I was and I told it who you were, and I gave it a paper that you and Tony Blair had written a couple of years ago, which is, you know, some excellent perspective on what science policy should be. And I said, I'm meeting William Hague. What are the types of things that I could talk about with him? And it came up with 8 or 10 suggestions, and I challenged some of them because they weren't good enough.
So we didn't really need to have you along to this discussion. Well,
I mean, for now, I think it's nice to have me. I'd be a bit more left field than the chatbot, but maybe in a few years.
Did these 8 to 10 things to discuss, they were good ideas, were they?
They were pretty good ideas if you and I were meeting for lunch. Less helpful for this particular conversation because you've got a particular direction in which you want to take it that I didn't know. So I couldn't feed that into the into the
but
system.
But within another year or two, that same program will probably predict all of those things.
It'll certainly get better, yeah. One of the most interesting things that we've learned over the year that these chatbots has been out is that when you put them in work contexts, they're incredibly equalizing. So academics from some of the best universities of the world have tested this in various places. And what they found is that the bottom half of employees have their work quality raised to the level of the top quarter. Now, that's wonderful if you're a boss, because you've now increased the number of first-rate employees you've got. But it's also wonderful if you're a human, and all of us are bottom 50% in something. You know, and now we've got something that helps us do better. And it's a bit like, you know, when I was a kid, when I moved from having a wooden tennis racket to fiber tennis rackets, my tennis improved. And I think that that is one of the humanizing dimensions of the technology that we don't talk about, which is we enable people.
So it's leveling up. This is great news for politicians who've promised leveling up, and this could deliver it. Unlike most of the other things,
it could be a leveling up
try. And it's a really important point, given a major problem in the world is inequality.
If we use it in the right way, it's enabling. But what the bosses choose to do, and how they choose to lean on the political establishment to push the playing field into their favour, is a different issue. And I think that what we can do is we can say the technology can help in these ways, but that doesn't stop the political argument and the argument of participation that still needs to go alongside.
Coming up, from disinformation to discrimination, what are the biggest problems with AI and how do we deal with them?
What we want to avoid is, I think, what happened in the early 1980s when the coal mines were shut down very, very quickly without actually any sense of where those workers would go next, right? We can learn from that painful experience.
That's in just a moment.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So if that's a glimpse of the excitement and the potential of AI, let's just have a quick look at the dangers. What's the most frightening thing that is happening in AI? There's obvious disinformation running up to elections. There can be discrimination inherent in the AI. What to you is the most frightening thing that is happening?
I think the most frightening is that the industry is concentrated around a few very big companies.
Right.
And we've known in history that concentrations of power, whether it's political power or business power, never serves the rest of us well in the long term. Whether it's Standard Oil in America from 150 years ago or any other very large, powerful business. And, you know, you don't need any technology insight to know that. You just need to be a student of history, which is too much unchecked power ends up with bad outcomes. So that's the thing that I do worry about more than most.
And that, again, thinking of my old profession as a politician, this is a huge problem, isn't it? Because Standard Oil was an incredibly powerful company in the late 19th century that all came crashing down in 1911 when the US Supreme Court said it was an illegal monopoly. You know, their power built up over decades, and then legislators had some years to work out what to do about it. But here in this exponential world, this comes very quickly. Politicians take a couple of years to notice what has happened. Then civil servants take a couple of years to advise them what to do. Then that's all done wrong in the first place. About 6 or 7 years later, you get some working body of regulation. By then, it's all changed. And competition law in business is set up in a particular way, but not really for a world in which businesses change so quickly. So for politicians, this is going to be an enormous problem, isn't it? It's already an enormous problem.
It is an enormous problem. So the next parliament, whenever it starts, that five-year period will be a critical period where AI will go everywhere. And the reason I say it will go everywhere is that if you look at how long it takes digital technologies to go from the niches to the mainstream, it's typically between about 7 and 10 or 12 years. I mean, the iPhone replaced the old Nokia phone with buttons in about 7 years. And lots of data shows that that is the amount of time this process will take. We've made arguments that AI is moving faster. And I think it is moving faster than something like the iPhone. So 5 years is long enough for us to go from a few of us nibbling around the edges of ChatGPT to this being used by every company and by every part of the public services and by every Briton. And so that's the period of time in which we have to get to grips with these issues and be proactive about intervening when we need to. We didn't do this with social media. You know, we've seen the harms writ large as a consequence. So I think it's a really important moment. And whoever will be sitting in number 10 for that period of time needs to make sure they've got their eyes on it.
Well, they really do. And that, and you kindly referred earlier to a paper I'd written with Tony Blair, which I would say Blair and I are like two old guys on a park bench now, ruminating about what might have been and what we would do. But we both think with the benefit of some distance, we can see what's happening, perhaps better than people who are in the the daily thick of politics, and whoever wins the next election is really going to have to be on top of this, and they're going to have to position this country to be at the forefront of innovation and artificial intelligence, but also to help people through this and safeguard against the dangers. I think you pointed out in your book that massive technological change almost always creates more jobs than it destroys, but it can have a very short-term adverse effect, a profound effect. It can destroy a lot of jobs in the early stages. Now, that sounds like social and economic upheaval. It sounds like that's a very disorientating and distressing thing for a lot of people. Is that what's on the way?
So the jobs question to me is really about, are British businesses in a position to take advantage of this technology to become more competitive and more productive and therefore grow? And if they grow, they will be able to hire more people and they will be able to hopefully develop local economies. Once we do that, we can then start to think about what support is needed for people who are in sectors where they can't now compete because of the nature of the technology. And that might involve actual government policy.
Just to explain that a bit more. You mean the government intervening to create work for those people, or to help them to retrain or be educated in a new way?
It has to start with great storytelling and great narratives. The sense of the economy is going to move into a better space, which means it will also be better for you. And once you have that narrative in place, you then have to back it up with the right set of policies to ensure that there is retraining and to ensure that it's easy for local businesses to grow quickly. So there are vacancies available for workers who are being retrained. Now, I'm not saying that the Exchequer has to fund all of this, but I do think that this is a place where a clear government policy can come in and ease that transition. What we want to avoid is, I think, what happened in the early 1980s when the coal mines were shut down very, very quickly without actually any sense of where those workers would go next, right? We can learn from that painful experience.
So you're saying a very big thing, really, which is in the next parliament, the next 5 years, change is going to happen on such a big scale that either the company, the government, whoever it is going to need to do something to really help a large number of people into new types of jobs. Well, what will those jobs be?
What we've seen in the past is that you move from a job that's data entry to a job that is about analyzing that data to a job that is then about making decisions on the analysis of the data. And so there is a ladder of upskilling that takes place. What you then need to be able to do is have a sufficiently entrepreneurial economy that allows businesses to take advantage of higher skilled workers. And that's why I think that this particular challenge is not a challenge that splits neatly across ideological lines. Because on the one hand, we need to make sure that there are policies that protect people during this period of economic change. But on the other hand, we need to have policies that drive entrepreneurialism. And so it is something that I think has to have a new kind of political consensus, rather than one that is coming from the right or coming from the left. And then, of course, there will be the jobs that robots or AI systems will struggle with, at least for the next few years, which will be the highly socialized jobs and places where we actually want there to be human connection, which might be in care, or it might be in education, or it might be in health.
I think this is one of the big issues here, isn't it, about AI. Is it going to give us more space to be human? Is it going to do a lot of the routine things, the boring things, that give us more time to spend with friends and families, more time to go out for a run on a spring morning? Or is it going to draw us into relationships with machines and being sucked into those algorithms and having our values and priorities decided somewhere else, that dystopian vision of the future? Is it going to make us more human or less human? Isn't that one of the big questions here?
It might do both. And which one wins out will depend person to person. Do I believe that through these technologies we can move at more of a human speed and more of a human scale? I believe it's possible. What would get in the way, I think, would be commercial incentives. So the incentives that, in particular, the big tech companies have for us to spend our time in their devices and making them, you know, advertising revenue. But also, I think, the desire to make things efficient so that rather than dealing with people, we deal with systems and we're forced to conform to those systems. And I think that that is part of what could be a grand debate of exactly what kind of interactions do we want with each other and how much of it do we want to feel is being driven by efficiency and how much of it do we want it to be what I picture as a lovely bucolic scene of you and Tony Blair sitting on a park bench somewhere in Wales looking at the sunset and just letting the clock tick.
Yes, that's a bit too bucolic. I think Tony Blair will definitely reject that vision. But everything that you've been saying makes the case very well for how people have to get ready for this. But how are we really going to make sure those big tech companies are joining in that exercise? I mean, you've just been talking about their power. Does that mean we have to start to regulate them as utilities, really? And so you've become an essential service. Mm-hmm. So now your prices are controlled by the government and the quality of what you do is overseen by regulators in detail. And we will force you to divest anything that is giving you an unfair competitive advantage. Or do we go even further? Do we say the people who run these companies, they have to be approved by Congress and Parliament? You know, they have to be elected in some way because their power is becoming greater than elected governments. I'm making up ideas here, yeah. But this is so huge that we are going to have to tackle these sorts of questions, aren't we?
We are going to have to tackle them. And I do think that there's a lot of what the big tech companies do that looks like a utility or an essential service. You cannot live in Britain in 2024 without internet access, without a mobile phone, without all of these digital services. There is a new agency called the Digital Markets Unit being set up in the Competition and Markets Authority. And one of the things that unit will be able to do is look at the tech companies and say, we think your market position is going to skew how consumers sort of experience the world or skew the competitive field. And we're going to ask you to do certain things to make sure that you don't do that. What I don't know is if it's sufficient to look at it solely through the lens of people as consumers, as opposed to a lens that is a wider civic lens, right? Well, how should we think of the average Briton as a citizen, as a member of a community, a member of a person who lives in a particular town, not just as someone who buys something for next day delivery? And I don't know where we get protected from those angles.
Let's just think about a couple of the other challenges it brings and what we can do about that. One is deep fakes and misinformation. Now, I've had for my entire political life, I had people impersonating me. I'm one of the most easily impersonated people by Rory Bremner and lots of other people.
Of course.
So I've always known there could be a fake of mine. Somebody once, when Tony Blair was prime minister, someone's got through to him in his bedroom pretending to be me, having got through the Downing Street switchboard saying, I'm William Hay and I want to talk to Tony Blair. They got straight through. But now somebody with a few seconds recording of my voice mm-hmm. or indeed anybody's voice can produce a pretty convincing fake of that person. We just don't know what to believe anymore.
The technology companies will work really hard to try to find technologies and systems that protect us from those types of fakes. The other thing we have to do is recognize that trust, skepticism, criticality within a society is not dependent on technology. It's dependent on a lot of other variables. And we have to work to strengthen those. Perhaps we can invest in people, in the types of media literacy, the questioning of authenticity and provenance that means some people are less susceptible to deepfakes than others. And there are countries like Finland and Singapore that have working policies within education that do that.
So it's a big challenge, but let's try to draw together what we've been discussing here. I saw an interview recently with a professor of AI from Stanford University in California. He's called Erik Brynjolfsson. He said, this could be the best decade ever in human history, but it could also be one of the worst. What do you think? Are we in for the best decade ever or one of the worst?
I think if things go south, it will be because of a really big political, geopolitical problem. I mean, it will be a war of some sort that would be involved one or two of the great powers. And it's just something that might happen that we can't necessarily control for. But if that doesn't happen, then the capacity that's created by AI and engaged citizenry creates the space that Erik Brynjolfsson is alluding to, high levels of productivity and enterprise and engagement. And if that comes to pass, we won't have seen a decade quite like it, probably not in living memory.
So as long as we can avoid that war, you are on the optimistic side of all of this.
I'm pragmatically optimistic because Britain is quite well placed for it. We have great universities. We've got an economy that has already moved towards being rather digital, which is what our services industry has been for a couple of decades. We also have access to capital with a thriving venture capital market that can support innovation. So lots of the building blocks are in place for us to take advantage of all of this. And I do think that once we know what the parliament will look like over the next 5 years, certain debates will go away and the country can start to concentrate on this opportunity.
Well, on that inspiring note, which I completely agree with, that is the big opportunity in this country. I think you've really demonstrated the massive importance of this to individuals, companies, governments. So thank you for your expertise and your knowledge and your optimism. Thank you very much, Azeem.
Thank you.
That was investor, entrepreneur, and global thought leader, Azeem Azhar. Today's producer was Olivia Case. The executive producers are Kate Ford and Fiona Leach. Sound design and our theme tune are by Mao Loseto, and I'm William Hague. If you've enjoyed this episode, you might like our previous one, called Artificial Intelligence, Bright New Future, or the End of Humanity. Here's a preview.
So the famous example is what's known as the paperclip example. So you create a super intelligent AI and say to it, can you just make paperclips? Fine. But the AI then decides that it really likes making paperclips and doesn't want to stop. And it's just going to keep using whatever material it can get to hand to make paperclips. And it could just destroy the human race just to make more paperclips.
There's a link to it in the description of this podcast. I'll be back every month with some of the world's leading figures and thinkers. I'm interested to hear your views too. Please get in touch. Our email is thestory@thetimes.co.uk. See you again soon.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.